So we have the KT extinction event. And now, why is it that birds survived, but the non-avian birds didn't? Dinosaurs didn't.
I'll tell you why modern birds survived.
Okay.
More or less. It's because they were bottom feeders. They were the things that survived the impact. Like, it's incredible how similar actually the survival after the apocalyptic, cataclysmic, world-ending thing that was the end Cretaceous impact is to survival after smaller but acute cataclysms that occur on Earth today, like volcanic eruptions, right? And what you see in any of those sorts of enormous, Ragnarok, Fimbulwinter, end of days kinds of scenarios, is that everything over a kilogram or a couple of kilograms in size just dies, right? Things that are big, they go out. They're either obliterated by the initial series of conflagrations and everything else, or there simply isn't enough stuff on Earth left to sustain them. So big things go out on land. The things that survive are animals in the rivers and lakes, which are temperature buffered by the water. And also they receive like a boost of input of food and everything because of all of the death that's running off from the surface into the water. Right.
Right.
And so they tend to come through. They come through both in modern cataclysms, and they came through in better shape. Things like crocodiles and alligators and turtles and stuff like that. They were big animals that lived in lakes and rivers that survived. So that's one way of doing it. On land, you survive if you're little tiny, if you reproduce on the ground or ideally underneath the ground, and if you're able to live in a desolated world, picking tiny bits of nutrition out of the ashes and devastation. And so the things that lived were little mammals that could eat the insects that were also feeding on the carrion of hundreds of millions of years of domination. They were things that could eat nuts and seeds. And among those things were the couple of lineages, actually, of modern birds that came through. And they differed from the other dinosaurs, the ones that went extinct, both because they were small, but they differed from the other small dinosaurs in that they nested on the ground. A lot of other early bird relatives seem to have nested in the trees, right?
Mm.
And that they seem to have been particularly suited to eating detritus or being detritivores, right? They were quite omnivorous. Nothing that had teeth survived, Those things were probably a little bit more carnivorous. Those parts of the food chain simply collapsed. But the birds that came through had beaks and were living much like chickens and tinamous and other simple ground fowl live today. They're laying their eggs on the ground, so their nesting materials weren't totally destroyed. They were able to hide in various places to shelter from the fires. And when they went looking for food, they had that characteristic humble thing that chickens and other birds do, which is what we call pecking, right? But what pecking actually is something that's very complicated, because what you're doing is you're looking at a ground surface that's mostly junk, and you're picking out the tiny little bits, little insects, little seeds, whatever, of good stuff out of a bunch of dross, out of a bunch of nothing. And you have to ingest that stuff very quickly to sustain the high bird metabolism. And that involves a really complicated series of coordinations between among the eyes and the brain and the specialized neck muscles, and also the beak, which in our research in my lab, we've argued serves as a sort of replacement for the hands as the hands became absorbed into the wing, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's this actual delicate, this incredibly silly, simple thing that birds do is actually a really important, really complicated thing. And going around pecking at the ashes, you know, in the ruins of the former world was what allowed them to survive. And it was from those bottom feeders that the modern bird radiations came.
So if anyone wants more on the bird's beak as a surrogate hand, and indeed a bird's neck as a surrogate arm, then the last full episode of Paleocast, we look at that for about an hour and a half or something like that. So yeah, it's huge area, birds. Right. But we know eventually, okay, everything recovered. We've got trees and forests now, and quickly after, well, reasonably quickly after the end Cretaceous mass extinction, things started to get better. Why didn't birds put the evolutionary bus into reverse and, you know, rediscover the fact that, you know, they had very relatively recent ancestors that were T-Rexes, that were raptors that went extinct? What was to stop them being able to rediscover those forms when it was, you know, basically in their DNA?
And this is more speculative as far as why birds didn't really kind of weren't able to revert back to old dinosaurian ways of doing things. I mean, for one thing, they did in part. For a while after the extinction, the largest predatory animals all over the world were not mammals. And for a while, I mean, for like 5 million years, they weren't mammals, they were archosaurs. There were crocodilians that came back onto land and started, you know, effectively trying to be dinosaurs. And there were birds that lost flight and became large, either omnivorous or predatory animals on the ground. And those predatory birds and the terrestrial crocs persisted for a long time in certain places, but they eventually encountered competition from mammals, right? So there was an attempt, is the answer. And at first it was kind of successful. But mammalian predators, I think, pretty clearly outcompeted those archosaurian attempts to once more assert dominance for whatever series of reasons. I mean, mammals are incredible in their own right. As far as why not kind of on some isolated island or something like that, flower into all kinds of varieties that more resembled, I don't know, ankylosaurs or stegosaurs or brontosaurs or something like that. Much is locked in DNA, right? And much that is not expressed in a normal organism is perhaps still in one's genome as far as history. So in a way we all carry our history around with us. But you know, the way birds develop in the egg is from a very early point in time, fairly specialized in a few different ways. In, as I've said before, the compactness of their overall body form, right? In the head, they appear to have lost several of the genes that are important for making teeth. And so they can't really do that again unless it's reinvented from whole cloth. And so I suspect that there are a lot of humps to get over. You know, I do work in embryology and developmental biology. And most alterations, you see lots and lots of mutant or otherwise perturbed chicks come out when you're hatching eggs. And it's very clear most changes are lethal. Or are very, very disadvantageous, right? And the bird body, to me, is so precisely assembled that it may be difficult to alter one component without breaking a lot of the rest of it, you know? And the parts that don't seem to be altered from a very early stage. They actually do play around with quite a bit. Like, for instance, we found in my lab that the arms look a lot like Velociraptor arms until really late in the game, and then they just suddenly change. And we know that among living birds, there's a bird called the Hoatzin, where they hatch still with kind of Velociraptor arms. And so they've been able to push that into their existence outside of the egg. But I would guess, you know, and the other thing is that we don't really know exactly why this is, but when animals gain flight, or at least when vertebrates gain flight, they seem to make their genomes smaller.
What?
Yeah, and this might relate to the fact that if you have a bigger genome, your cells are bigger. And so it might have something to do with tissue lightness or complexity or something like that, or maybe a surface area to volume thing with getting nutrition, or who knows. But bird genomes are actually, like, they're really small. So they've shed a lot of genes and a lot of parts of genes too. That all may make it harder to redevelop into kind of the variety of things that were present in the time of the dinosaurs. Does that make some sense?
It does make sense. It also makes completely no sense. Like, do other paleontologists know this? Is it just me that doesn't know this?
I'd say some do. I think having been trained, having intended to be a biologist for, you know, most of my early career has been really useful. Because I do look at things like, not just a biologist. I was preparing to be basically a biochemist, cell biologist.
Mm.
And I come at things first from that perspective. And I think it's a useful thing to do. You know, where I lack is in geological knowledge, which is something that a lot of paleontologists have and is really great for understanding the context in which animals lived and the big patterns that occurred in the history of life.
I come from.
Right. And you have to make sacrifices somewhere. And then, of course, and then also, you have to kind of move on. I mean, I also did the thing, you know, I was in graduate school for either 9 or 10 years. I can't remember. So, you know, it took a long time, like, training. Yeah, which is unusual, especially in the UK. But I did a master's for 3 years and then a PhD for 6. So I really wanted to, you know, establish a broad knowledge base.
You know? For sure. And you were so right to open with that in the first part of this series.
Right. I wouldn't recommend it. Being in graduate school for that long. I'm not saying that's a model to follow. Like, there's probably some balance that can be struck. Nonetheless.
But these things are so important. They're so fundamental to animals. And I mean, to understand that tells you more about their evolution than coming from it from my point of view, which is just, this is the context in which we find them now. Of course, there's information that you can learn from both sides. And in an ideal world, you'll have both sides of the coin in there and a training in both. But to just hear these details for the first time, to think about these things, to conceive them, have them explained to me for the first time, it's incredible the kinds of things that animals, that organisms are capable of doing, or that have by some chance ended up going through that process.
Yeah, but you know, all of this stuff, this kind of the embryological work and the extant biological work, I mean, you know, all of it can be blown out of the water, all of our inferences, by the discovery of a single fossil, you know? And that has happened multiple times. And so there's really nothing. The thing that paleontology brings is the recorded truth of the history of life. And to me, nothing compares to that. Nothing.
Completely agree. Right. So how quick was the radiation of birds following the KPG mass extinction and Cretaceous mass extinction?
Seems incredibly rapid. Birds are really delicate, and so they're not easily preserved, and so their fossil record is not very good. But we have a few great windows on them from various times. Another thing that saves us with the bird fossil record is that because each one of their bones is so precisely machined, that they can be identified and phylogenetically placed or classified, however you want to think about it, from very small parts of their skeletons. And by, you know, about 5 million years after the extinction, many of the distinctive modern groups had already appeared and were showing some of the characteristic adaptations of those groups even. So very fast, very, very fast. Faster, I would wager, than the mammalian diversification into the various forms of mammals that we see today. That's a qualitative assessment.
Okay, what drove that then? Why were they able to diversify rapidly?
I think the ability to fly, right, means that you can just fill a space so much more efficiently. And at this time, there was environments were developing that were in some ways more heterogeneous and interesting than those during the Mesozoic. You had huge forests made of flowering trees, flowering plants. You had all kinds of environments. Like penguins come in very early on, in fact. You know, you have these cold environments that birds with their fast metabolisms can inhabit too. And so they were just able, again, to fill space three-dimensionally. They were able to disperse rapidly because they could fly. They have these little devices in their bodies that are very easily modified genetically. So the beak, right, and parts of the wing and the feet, they're these wonderful little modules that can just be tweaked over and over and over again to achieve all kinds of different purposes. And they also, one thing that really determines rate of evolution is how quickly you live and die. It's your generation time. It's the amount of time between when you hatch and when you lay eggs. And birds are small animals. They live fast and they reproduce quickly. The more generations, the more evolution happens.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to think about something like Darwin's finches, where they do change the shapes of the beaks between islands and stuff like that. And when you think about the spaces, as you say, the 3D space, if you had any given environment, for example, a forest, you can live on the forest floor, you could live up a tree, you could live in the canopy of the tree. You can live in the space above the canopy of a tree if you're a bird. There's more eco space to live in and more. Can you cut up your environments more slices of the pie for more species if you're a bird? Does it work like that?
That's what I strongly believe that's the case, and that is a big part of their success. And again, you know, they're little animals, right? The other thing, like an individual bird is incredibly, because they're so light, they're so efficient. It's an incredibly small amount of biomass, right? Mm. And the less biomass an individual takes up, I mean, the more individuals there can be, and the more individuals there can be, the more evolution happens.
That's a really important point. I never thought of that. You know what? I'm going to enroll at Yale.
You just pick these things up, you know, and some of them are right and some of them are wrong, but, you know.
Okay. Why then haven't we seen similar radiations after the evolution of flight in bats and pterosaurs.
Yeah, I mean,
small bodies flying, the same could be true for them, couldn't it?
Yeah. I'm not so bats actually have had an enormous radiation. They're one of the most speciose and diverse groups of mammals, right? So in that, bats are sort of a positive example in that way. On the other hand, you know, the bat flight apparatus and body apparatus, I mean, people can argue back and forth about it, but it's not really as sophisticated as the bird apparatus. And I would guess that bats truly are competitively excluded by birds from a lot of niches. I think otherwise there would be day living diurnal bats. You know, they exist at night, I think, kind of for a reason. They also, just because of some quirk, actually bats, I think, I may be incorrect in this, but they may actually have rather long, weirdly long generation times. And so their entire rate of evolution, it's possible, is possibly slower. But again, that may not be the case. Pterosaurs, it's an open question, I would say. I mean, for one thing, they're so delicate that I'm not sure that we have a very good estimate of their diversity, period, at most times in Earth's history. And you get things like in the Morrison, which is where I sometimes work, as far as field work, going and digging up fossils, right? The Morrison, preferentially, in many cases, well, depending on where you go, it preserves a lot of big animals, right? You get these channel deposits, river channel deposits, where you get brontosaurus and allosaurus and stuff like that, right? Very few small animals. And then you get these little pockets, little ponds or whatever they are, that have small animals preserved. And you find this an enormous variety of little things that were undoubtedly more numerous than the big dinosaurs, but that you would never have known existed if not for these couple of little sites. And, you know, here and there you find a little part of a pterosaur, but they're so delicate. So in a way, who knows whether they did in fact diversify as much as, or almost as much as, birds. There has been some work, I think maybe some of it was even out of Bristol, possibly, that has posited that as stem birds took off and started invading aerial and semi-aerial niches, that they may have competitively excluded small pterosaurs, and that pterosaurs tend to, you lose the little ones and you tend to get big specialized ones at that point too, you know? I'm not sure. It is.
I'm sure someone in the comments will.
It's really difficult to make conclusions about that sort of thing when you're dealing with the sort of fossil record that we have for terrestrial Mesozoic vertebrates, is something I would say. But also, you know, that idea actually, it's funny. I'm not sure I'd be satisfied with the evidence that's been, you know, adduced to that, but it feels right to me, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we just look then at birds today, we know they are hugely diverse, but how disparate a group are they? And could you explain the difference between diversity and disparity?
Yeah. When we're talking about diversity, we're often talking about species diversity, which is simply, I mean, how many species there are, or how many branches off of the tree there are, or how many branches happened within a certain period of time, or something like that. And by most of those measures, birds are extremely diverse, right? There are somewhere between 10 and 15,000 living species of birds. There are only about 5,000 species of mammals, right? But what I sometimes say when I'm teaching a broad course like herpetology or the history of life, is that all birds are basically the same animal.
Right.
And that's disparity, right? Disparity is the variety that one sees in other characteristics, like body form, primarily, physiological characteristics. I mean, also all sorts of things, whatever measure you want to take of something's life and the way in which it functions. The bird, as if you compare them to, say, mammals, which are of roughly the same vintage, at least Therian mammals. So they both, no, they're not. Therian mammals are older. If you compare them to placental mammals, maybe, or higher placental mammals even, you know, something that's around the same age, some group that's the same age in mammals, birds have much less disparity of body form. You know, mammals have produced whales and elephants and manatees and lions and tigers and bears and us, right? Birds, it's relatively small variations on the same overall body plan. The compact trunk, big pelvis, big arms that are wings, very specialized, highly articulated neck, you know, that head with the beak, and there are lots and lots of subtler variations within that. But I don't know, like, what are the most disparate birds? The whole songbird radiation is a group that includes miniaturized again, and so they're kind of interesting in that way. You know, hummingbirds are interesting functionally. Are their skeletons extremely different? Not really. Like penguins, maybe? Perhaps penguins are the most divergent birds? And you can still really tell that they're birds from their skeletons.
Yeah, the way I always like to think about diversity and disparity is by going to a bar. You go to one that specializes in beer, and you can get 100 different types on tap. And you'd say, wow, what huge diversity of beers. Right, but then you go to another bar, they've also got 100 things, but it's 100 different types of drink.
Right.
You can get a shot of melted chocolate if you want.
Right.
So that's the disparity. Right. So we've talked a lot about their success. We've got a different species of bird for every possible niche and environment and way of living. And they're all pretty much the same. But are there any ecologies, any ways of living or environments that birds still particularly struggle with or just haven't managed to be able to get into?
Yeah. In a couple of ways, right? Penguins are okay at diving, but mammals, for instance, with whales, have really cracked the deep, deep ocean environment. And we think that some extinct non-avian reptiles probably did as well. Birds haven't quite managed to do that yet. Why? Not really sure. But again, their body forms are very constrained. And then they're pretty obviously competitively excluded from the big land living niches by mammals. Like that's quite obvious. Because large ground-dwelling birds often go extinct when they come in contact with mammals. Otherwise, they occupy very specific parts of the kind of ecological space.
Okay. And in general, how important are birds to modern ecosystems?
Yeah, that's a good question. They're not a huge amount of the biomass, right? They're at points they're important pollinators, and they're sources of food for various small organisms, seed dispersal and so on, right? You know, it's funny. Someone's gonna tell me I'm totally wrong about this. I'm not sure that they're extremely important.
Oh no.
In a broad sense.
I completely agree. But we're gonna get shouted at.
You know what's important is insects and annelids, but especially
now you're talking plants, sense, yes.
Right. Plants and, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, fish are in some ecosystems, and large mammals are in some ecosystems. Birds. I've thought about this a little bit. I'm not sure they're that significant. Sorry. They're very beautiful, though.
That's true. So, on that bombshell.
I'm sorry, everyone. Danfield, I'm really sorry, bud, but.
I can hear Danfield crying from
here. You know, I was on his committee, so he was sort of my student, and then he was my postdoc too before he went out to the UK. So yeah. I would give him shit about birds all the time, you know. Because whole shtick was that I hate birds, you know, and he loves birds and so, right, anyway, we had this kind of act.
He's gonna love this then, isn't he? Yeah.
I hope so. Hi, Dan. Okay.
Nobody tell Dan we had this conversation. Let's leave it there before the bird fans come after us both. Yeah. And I will thank you very much. It has been incredibly fascinating. I have personally learned an absolute ton from this, and I have enjoyed every second of it. Thank you.
Yeah, it's been great. Thanks so much for doing this.